Godspeed with Carol Hollenbeck, Sundays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Godspeed Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom in an effort to help people better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster peace. I'm your host, Carol Hollenbeck. Abbas Barzagar is Assistant Professor of Islam in the Department of Religious Studies at Georgia State University. An associate of the Middle East Institute, his areas of interest include contemporary Islamic political movements, Shiism, and Islam in America. He is co-editor of Islamism, Contested Perspectives on Political Islam, published by Stanford University Press in 2009, and his latest work is The Persistence of Heresy, Paul of Tarsus, Ibn Saba, and Historical Narrative in Sunni Identity Formation. Dr. Barzagar, welcome to the Institute, and thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you, Carol. Thank you for having me.
You know, there's such an expansive topic here when we discuss any world religion with the history and texture and nuance, includes Islam, of course. But why don't we begin with the central figure of the Prophet Muhammad himself? Can you share about who he was? And please take your time. You have the floor.
Okay, I appreciate the opportunity to speak sort of freely about this. Oftentimes, Muhammad is a very contested, you know, figure in our public discourse about religion and morality and ethics, and I often begin such talks and writings with what I call Muhammad between Dante and Deepak. And I don't mean to be glib here, but the way that I sort of read public discourse these days about Muhammad is sort of in this binary, in this dichotomy out there that on one hand is inspired and is really a continuing tradition of a long, multi-century European disdain for the figure of Muhammad, whether that was pre-Enlightenment or post-Enlightenment, exemplified in figures like Dante, where Muhammad is cast as a fraud, a villain, the, you know, inventor of a false religion, the false prophet, etc., and the Quran being a book of sort of a madman, a mad poet. And again, these polemics go back very, very far, but today if you go to Barnes & Noble or Borders or any bookstore for that matter, you're likely to find something in the Dante genre, if I will, of Islamophobia-related conversations on the figure of Muhammad. Now, in part as a reaction to that, and also in part part of the whole phenomena of Muslims trying to show the best of their religion and, you know, really sort of represent the religion best in this society and in Western societies, is what I would call the Deepak syndrome. And this is a Deepak Chopra, of course, we love his work, and I'm not taking anything away from him. But what I mean is there is a overreaction, in my estimation, to the Dante narrative, which is exemplified in the sort of Deepak narrative, which is that Muhammad was a prophet that was a humanist, that was somebody who exemplified sort of liberal values, pluralist values, and was a prophet even of our age. I believe that's one of the subtitles of one of his biographers by a non-Muslim, by a popular non-Muslim writer. And so you have both non-Muslims and Muslims, both academic and popular, all writing about the character of the Prophet Muhammad. And what's interesting is that for the historian, and I consider myself to be sort of in the line of traditionally trained historian in the academic world, this binary and this dichotomy really misses the point altogether when it comes to conversations on Muhammad, because we're really dealing with the same problem that many Christian historians of Christianity deal with when they're dealing with the figure of Jesus, and that is, how can we even establish who he was, when he lived, etc. And this is a raging debate just on a kind of source, you know, source material level, a very academic level. And so it's interesting that as academics now, we are asked to sort of participate in this conversation. So I just wanted to introduce that as sort of my forefront piece before I continue. Is there anything that you wanted to ask about that before I continue?
Well, yes, just to clarify for our listeners, the Dante you're referring to, would that be the author of Inferno?
Yes, absolutely.
That Dante.
And it's because Muhammad in the Inferno is represented as that false prophet figure.
So he was placed in there by... In the one of the nine circles of hell.
Absolutely.
By Dante at the time.
Exactly, and Dante didn't come up with that. I mean, this is a tradition that goes back very early, actually, as early as 9th century England. We have examples of monastic writings against the Prophet Muhammad, and it's part of obviously a reaction of Christendom. Or yet to be Christendom,
right.
Really, to the advent of Islam, which really struck world history at a quite impressive level at that time in terms of its expansion, its rapid expansion so quickly across the world. So what can we know about Muhammad and who he was? Well, as far as all major world religion figures are concerned, the source material is pretty clear that Muhammad was a historical figure that lived in the 6th and 7th century Arabia, and that for the most part the historical materials that we have are from the Islamic tradition, meaning written in Arabic, and many of those writings are redacted about a century or two later after his death. But we have even contemporary writings from the time from Byzantine and Syriac chroniclers, and so this is very important because we have actually a more of a handle in terms of hard evidence on his life and who he was, and it seems, again, at the raw historical level, that he was a Semitic prophet in the Arabian Peninsula who was, like many prophets and saints in that area at the time, one compelled by maybe a messianic belief, the idea that the end of days is near and that the new religious movement was really being established to set up, for lack of better terminology, set up God's kingdom on earth. And so you have very much an archetype of a warrior prophet who falls perfectly in line with figures like David or Solomon in the Bible. And so from a broad historical level, that's sort of what can be established just at an objective level. But really that matters less than what Muslims believe him to have been. And Muslims of all stripes, Sunni, Shiite, Sufi, you know, and sects of each one, all believe that Muhammad was either, you know, manifestly infallible and a perfect human being, or, you know, protected by God to be the perfect human being, free of error, free of sin. And the Sufis have a common saying that is, he was a man and he was a human being, flesh and blood, but that doesn't mean that he was like us, in that you can call a ruby a stone, but you clearly are missing something if you do that. And so so this is how most Muslims look at him, as Muslims refer to the Prophet Muhammad as the best of creation, the mercy to all of creations, the best teacher, the best guide. All of these sort of titles are there. And so it is in his exemplary ethics, dealings with family, dealings with society, dealing with government, that we find the best examples for how to deal with the world. And Muslims are constantly referring back to that concept, which they call the Sunnah. Sunnah is the term, and sometimes I refer to it for my students as sort of the way of Muhammad. And this is the general concept of Muhammad's overarching character, ethics, and actions. And so the Sunnah is the reference point for all Muslims. And of course, that's where the word Sunni comes from. So we can move into a little bit more about that. Would you like to know sort of about specifics in his life and things like this?
Well, you know, it's interesting because there's a similarity here where, you know, we have, for example, the image of Jesus in Scripture and all the spiritual lessons that go through that. But then on the other hand, there has also been this search for what's been called the historical Jesus. Like, yeah, but who was he really?
Mm-hmm.
And there's that... you know, you used the word binary.
Yes.
There's a kind of duality involved here with these central figures being both, you know, 100% human and perhaps, and the Christians would believe Jesus is also 100% divine. Simultaneously, we seem to have some difficulty with the with that kind of harmony.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, we split it up. But is there, you know, what an historical Muhammad?
Well, you know, truth be told, you can't really talk about a historical Muhammad in terms of his life and actions exactly without really giving 100% over to the Islamic sources themselves. And what I mean by that is that once we say this is what Muhammad did as a positive fact and who he was as a character, et cetera, beyond the outline, the skeletal outline that I provided earlier, once you do that, you're really participating in a kind of theological discourse. And so we know, and we can assume that he was a warrior prophet, and by all accounts, fit that mold. And he spoke in this way in terms of God's authority. And so, you know, what you want to know about Muhammad in terms of his daily life, his routine, and whatnot, is going to have to be interpreted through the sources. Which, by the way, despite sectarian differences in Islam, is pretty uniform. The skeletal structure of his life, and sort of the contours of when he began his prophetic call and who his immediate followers were and all of these things, is remarkably uniform across the Muslim traditions. They're simply nuances that I think other, you know, outsiders would find laughable that differentiate the major sects in Islam and movements.
Well,
in Islam.
Briefly, I would be interested in hearing about the time of his prophetic call, because I understand it happened basically what we would call midlife.
Yes, he was 40 years old when it happened, and so before that, and this happens in the year 610 on our calendar, and so the year 610 on our calendar. The Prophet Muhammad becomes the Prophet Muhammad. And before that, he was a well-known sort of member of the Hashemite clan of the Quraysh, all right, the Hashemite tribe of the Qurayshi clan, I should say, in Mecca. And the Hashemites had long been known to be the caretakers of the pilgrimage site in Mecca, which is, most folks will be familiar with the Kaaba, the black sort of cubicle structure at Mecca. Well, this had been a place of pilgrimage for Bedouin Arabs for centuries and centuries on end, and even pre-Islamic tradition has it that this site was established by Abraham and his son Ismail, you know, in Islamic tradition, Ishmael, as a place of pilgrimage for the worship of one God. And so the Hashemite clan were always the caretakers of that pilgrimage site. Now, it had become, according to tradition, a location where the Bedouin tribes, polytheistic in nature, polytheistic in nature, for lack of a better term right now, they would converge at Mecca and sort of make worship to the gods of their respective tribes. And Muhammad was believed to have been part of a movement at the time that did not participate in any of the established religious traditions. It was called the Hanif movement, and it's somewhat opaque about, you know, whether this is historically, you know, if we can actually confirm this historically, or whether this is part of a later sort of Islamic tradition. But the idea is that Muhammad was never a polytheist, that he always worshipped one God and one God alone, and he did that in a very sort of pure, natural way, and it fits into the Islamic belief that all human beings are created with an instinct, a fitra, a natural disposition for the worship of one God. And so Muhammad had participated in that sort of worship, which involved a lot of meditation and retreat to the country, you know, to the hills, I should say, the mountains, caves, and whatnot, and standard meditation, fasting. And then on one of these occasions, he was struck with the message from the Archangel Gabriel that he is to be the last messenger and to bring the message of the Quran forward. And so because of his impeccable integrity, amongst the the tribesmen in Mecca at the time, he had a lot of sort of, for lack of a better term, political capital, and it was a very serious move that that a man like Muhammad of the Hashemite clan would be making such a claim. And so thus begins his prophetic call at the age of 40. And he stayed in Mecca preaching a very simplistic, very apocalyptic, kind of ethically universal message of, you know, God consciousness for 13 years in Mecca. I mean, the majority of his life as a prophet, and his career as a prophet, was spent just talking about sort of, you know, recognition of every human being's own mortality, the impending, you know, coming of the day of judgment and sort of the last day, sort of a reminder of the impermanence, and then also all kinds of social, basic social and ethical injunctions like taking care of the poor, taking care of the orphans, paying attention to sort of disparity and inequality and oppression. And so all of these themes are what constitute the bulk of the Quranic message. And those are all revealed to Muhammad in that 13 years in Mecca. And it's not until after that 13-year period where his movement had grown to a point that it had come into conflict with the senior leaders, the polytheists basically at Mecca, that the movement took a political tone, and Muhammad moved to Mecca in the year 620, or excuse me, I should say Medina, in the year 623. And in the year 623 is where we begin a new career in the life of the Prophet Muhammad, in that we now start seeing Islam form as a social and political movement, and the Quran begins now to speak about things like laws, organization, inheritance, you know, basically, you know, everything that you can think about in terms of running a society. And so this, you know, this continues for some time before the Muslims eventually defeat the ruling elites at Mecca, and the entirety of the Arabian Peninsula is actually consolidated under Muhammad's sort of uniform rule, or unified rule, I should say, at Mecca. And Mecca, the Kaaba itself, the cubical structure, is restored for the worship of one God. And so Muslims hold this to be the sacred narrative, and that narrative, again, is standard across Islamic tradition. And so there's the Meccan period, the Medinan period, and what happens during that time, and in each of these different cases, is very important for later Muslim tradition in terms of how they develop Islamic law, Islamic theology, the whole body of Islamic ethics is going to be determined by how one relates to this sacred narrative of, you know, the Prophet Muhammad's life.
Well, yes, and that's fascinating. And I'm wondering then, could you share with us or begin the conversation of then the development of the different Muslim groups from there?
What are you most familiar with? Of course, the Sunni and Shiite, or the Sufis, would you like to hear about? I imagine Dr. Nasser spoke about the Sufi tradition quite a bit. I mean, when I found out that he was your previous guest, I was hesitant to come on. I didn't know what else
him. No, you should listen to that show. It's a lot of fun, too.
He's all of our teachers. He's a great man.
But thank you. No, I mean, we've all heard the terms, you know, culturally, the Sunni Muslims, the Shiite Muslims. What actually differentiates the groups?
Well, what differentiates the groups is really a matter of a very simple historical question, and that is, did the Prophet Muhammad appoint a successor to take his position as community leader and as sort of spiritual guide, not prophet, but as spiritual guide, because Islamic tradition holds that Prophet Muhammad is the last final of all prophets, and there will be no communication basically between, you know, God and another prophet. You know, it's pretty much the done deal. It's the last and latest version of Windows, if you will, you know. And
right.
So the question becomes, who gets to take control of the community? You're talking about a political movement at this point that is taking over the entirety of the Arabian Peninsula at a moment in history, on world history, where the Persian Empire and the Byzantine Empire are both sort of beating each other to rags and have become weak. And so if one looks at the map and thinks that the Western Hemisphere doesn't exist, if they look at the Arabian Peninsula between East Africa and the Red Sea and the Persian Gulf and the Indian Ocean and the Mediterranean Ocean, you know, the Arabian Peninsula sits at pretty much the intersection, the crossroads of the entire world. All goods, all silks that any pope would want to wear, that any feudal, you know, kind of king in Europe would want to wear,
right.
Any sugar, any spice, anything like that, would have to go through the Arabian Peninsula in one way or another. And most Arabs had, up until this time, been sort of vassal states of either the Byzantines or the Persians, and now you have a political movement that is capable of managing its own affairs and having its own say on the world stage, and so the stakes are very, very high. You know, we're not talking about just Mecca and Medina anymore and sort of pilgrimage sites and the monies and the taxes that would come through wayfaring Bedouins passing through the territory. You're talking about Damascus. You're talking about Jerusalem. I mean, these are huge, huge issues. And so the question becomes, did he appoint a successor or not? And the Shiites believe, you know, very explicitly on multiple occasions that the Prophet Muhammad did indeed appoint his cousin and son-in-law, Ali, to be his successor, and they consider this to be an absolutely undisputable fact, and that the Sunnis, from a Shiite perspective, the Sunni Muslims, or basically everybody else, because at that time there's not really Sunnis, everybody else sort of denied this. They, you know, thought that maybe it wasn't an explicit or divinely mandated one decision, but by and large they feel that this was not an explicit decision, because Ali did not take the command after the Prophet Muhammad's death. Instead, one of his senior lieutenants, who Abu Bakr is his name, who is the first of what they call the rightly guided caliphs, took command of the community, and he was, from the very inception of Muhammad's mission, one of his biggest supporters. He is somebody who was an elite Quraishi at the time, who gave over stacks and stacks and loads of his wealth for the cause, for the movement, and he was one of the most elder people in the movement, and so it was natural amongst the tribesmen at the time to choose him as a successor. So the mere fact that he was the historical successor, and the Shiites believe that he shouldn't have been, is really the entire cause of the conflict. Sunnis believe that what happened is what was supposed to happen, in a sense, and it was sort of, it was not that Muhammad did not leave a will or a testament on how things should be done after him, but it was left to the community as a whole to decide, and so what happened is what happened, and it should have happened that way. And Shiites believe that something terrible went wrong in history. And at that time, you have a number of different groups. It's even false to speak about Sunnis and Shiites in the first two centuries of Islamic history, because you're really embroiled in what is empire history. And, you know, that's a story just like many other empires in history, which is pretty mundane. It's about kings, you know, kings running large fortunes and embellishing their, you know, their cousins and their kinsmen,
right.
And movements, rival political movements, trying to overthrow that. But the very discourse of Islam, of who Muhammad was, of what he said, of what the community is, and how the Quran is to be interpreted, all fall into that sort of empire history, the politics of empire history. So, you know, at fundamental core is that Shiites believe that Ali was supposed to be the successor, and that he wasn't chosen as an act of betrayal amongst the top sort of lieutenants of Muhammad, and Sunnis say that that is just impossible, that it was outlandish, and that the idea of Muhammad appointing a successor is really just a Shiite lore that comes into play much later to justify sort of their own deviant positions. So this is, sectarian polemics is a headache, to say the least.
In terms of text, though, is there anything written that would, first of all, you know, confirm Muhammad's choice of his cousin and son-in-law, and that they in fact turned it down? I mean, where does this come from?
Well, there's nothing to say that he turned it down, but the idea that he appointed appointed Ali comes through a number of different narratives that Sunnis simply do not consider authentic. But some of the earliest sources that we have, period, say that there were certain moments in the Prophet's life where he explicitly designated his successor. And the polemics are so intense, and really, you have to credit some of the people for their perseverance in studying these things. Some of the polemics are so intense that they literally will publish books and volumes of books over the definitions of certain words used in a sentence and a phrase that Muhammad used to, title Ali. And so it really comes down to these things. So Sunnis will say, yes, he said that, but it didn't mean that he should have been the successor. It meant that, you know, he's a great guy and that everybody should respect him.
He was the beloved disciple.
Exactly. And others, yeah. Others say, well, no, he said that right after this happened. And the Sunnis say, no, actually, it didn't have to, after that, it happened after this. And, I mean, it's I've written about this in my dissertation, and others, many greater than I, have written about this in more detail. But the very idea that what we're dealing with isn't a theological issue, but a matter of historical interpretation, is I think is enough to kind of get people, or at least make people interested in what's happening. We're not dealing with, in the Christian case, the nature of Jesus's, body, for example.
Right.
And his flesh and the relationship between his kind of presence in this world and his status as an incarnation of God. You're dealing
right.
with simply what happened and what did that mean. And so everything that you want to look at, all the texts, really, with everything else, you'd have to participate, that is, to pick a side to say what exactly happened. And most Western sources out here... in, let's say, the kind of popular academic world, they have mostly adopted and appropriated the Sunni belief that that Muhammad did not execute a successor. But from my own research, I think that that's just sort of something that happens when you see a dominant group and you kind of take the dominant story and the dominant narrative seeps into your own narrative unconsciously,
Well, Doctor, we are about halfway through our program already. You are listening to the Godspeed Institute live on the Progressive Radio Network. We are going to take a short break. After the break, we will continue our conversation on the history and future of Islam, and I think we'll be mincing more words too, with Dr. Abbas Barzagar of Georgia State University. Let's spend a couple of minutes now with the artist Yusuf Islam and an old favorite. Stay with us.
Now I've been happy lately, thinking about the good things to come, and I believe it could be something good has begun. Oh, I've been smiling lately, dreaming about the world at one, and I believe it could be someday it's going to come. Cause out on the edge of darkness, there I something good has begun. Peace train sound in
Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute. I'm your host, Carol Hallenbeck. We're talking about Islam with Abbas Barzagar of Georgia State University. We've been discussing the figure of the Prophet Muhammad in real life and his journey and his prophetic call at the age of 40. And we were just discussing the development of the different groups of Islam, specifically I guess, breaking off of the Shiite Muslims, Doctor?
Yes, it can be considered a breaking off or sort of a mutual and sort of reciprocal development over time. And it's a pretty complex history. The Sunni group basically becomes, let me back up for one second, the Muslim movement takes the form of an empire, the first empire being the Umayyad dynasty that runs from about 661 to 750, and then after that, 750 to 1258 is the Abbasid Empire. And most of the grandeurs of Islamic civilization that folks might be nominally familiar with, such as the advances in technology and science and sort of world travel and the establishment of the Islamic borders from Spain to India and China, all of this happens within those first five centuries of Islamic history. And Sunni Muslims are increasingly uncomfortable, or a group of Muslims, I should say, are increasingly uncomfortable with the imperial nature of the religious form and believe that something has been lost. And so a group emerges of scholars and a network of scholars across the territory that are also very uncomfortable with the various Shiite movements that are laying claim to authenticity and to their own political projects. And so the Sunni Islam becomes sort of the de facto religion of the Muslim Commonwealth, if I can say that properly. Mm-hmm. So I don't mean to say that it's a state religion or that the state defined the religion in any way, but it basically means the overall community that is not Shiite, that is not hyper-sectarian, and is not explicitly part of the government's sort of court and whatnot. And so in this way, Sunni Muslims themselves, they believe they are the community, and the very name of Sunni Islam is Ahl Sunnah wal Jama'ah, which is the people of the prophetic precedent and the community, capital C, and that is the community of Muhammad, the community that is on the Sunnah. And so Sunni Islam in that way becomes similar to the way Protestant Christianity functions, and that is you can't really understand any of it unless you approach it through one of its branches. And you can only, you know, how would you define Protestantism if, as any one thing? You would simply say those Christian groups that aren't Catholic, you know, or aren't Orthodox, right? And so in the same way, that's what you have to do with Sunni Islam. And so Sunni Islam really emerges, and this is the subject of my dissertation, and my major scholarly research, is that it emerges, I believe, as an explicit sectarian identity between the 10th and 11th centuries. And this is at a time where the empires are collapsing into vassal states, and the caliph is becoming, the caliph being the, some, you know, the religious head, the head of state of the community. It becomes clear that the caliph is a worldly office, and it's simply a Islamic kind of kingship. And so what happens is that that office of caliph gets deprived of any serious religious authority other than sort of having to exist for certain legal reasons. And real religious authority lies within the hands of the clerics, and they begin to develop a number of systems of theology and law that parallel much of the rabbinic tradition. And this is how Sunni Islam proceeds. And it's very important to think about Sunni Islam in that Protestant sense, in that you have a very horizontal nature of religious authority. You have a number of different groups, a number of different schools, legal schools, theological schools, and there is some collective order to them, but by and large, you know, there are pedagogical institutions in place for the lay believer to follow. Much different than Shiite Islam. Shiite Islam and all of its branches historically have been much more like a Vatican Catholic type of structure where you have a very rigid hierarchy, and the Shiites that are dominant today, the Twelver Shiites that we call in Iran and Iraq, you can think of them as a Catholicism without a pope. Instead, you have a kind of council of senior learned scholars, and each one of those scholars has a network of parishes, if you will, underneath them, and they are all very theologically uniform. Theologically, they're very uniform, and there's some small differences in law here or there. But for organizational purposes, it's very important to know that Shiites are very, very vertical, hierarchical, and rigid, and Sunnis are broad, horizontal, and it's very hard to ever approach anything like a pyramidal structure in,
yes,
in Sunni Islam.
Yes, Protestant.
Yeah. Yeah,
that was a good analogy there. Now, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned the clerics there. Would you please share the, what are the different roles, clerical roles? And if you could identify some of them and the particular areas of responsibility.
You know, in all sects and aspects of Muslim life, the Muslim believer uses the idea of being on a road, on a spiritual journey, if you will, to understand their own religiosity on a day-to-day basis, and this has become institutionalized within Islamic culture. So the word Sharia itself, which we all know has sort of a bad name out there today, the word Sharia itself is derivative of Share, which is road, which is way. And in the same way, the Sufi brotherhoods, the Sufi orders that we are familiar with, those are called tariqah, and it's also derivative of another word for road or way. And basically, all of these pedagogical institutions that exist all give the indication of being on a way. And so every way, every road that one would want to encounter would need a guide. And the cleric's role is simply to be a guide. And the believers are understood to be in a kind of caravan of sorts, being guided by certain leaders along the way. And so the cleric's number one duty is to make explicit what has to be done and how they're supposed to be done to be a Muslim. You really can't go very far as a practitioner in Islamic belief without relying upon a scholar at some point, a cleric at some point, simply for informational purposes. Okay, Muslims advocate the direct reading of the Quran. You don't need, let's say, an intermediary to interpret it for you. And, you know, the popular reading of the Quran from the earliest ages into later is widely encouraged. But say, for example, one wants to learn how to pray. Well, the directions on how to pray aren't found in the Quran explicitly. The injunction to do so and how many times to do so is. But exactly how to do that, one would need some direction. And the clerics, simply being scholars, are the ones who know that information, and they derive that information from a variety of sources, but it's their job to basically make it clear and make it plain to the believer on what needs to be done. We're talking about prayer, we're talking about fasting, and then we get into social issues, beyond ritual issues, on how to conduct family life, how to conduct inheritance law, how to deal with marriage. And so it's mainly a legal and ethical demand on the practitioner's life as a Muslim that necessitates the existence of a clerical class. Very much similar, again, to the rabbinic model in Judaism.
And in terms of the clerics, are there different roles or offices in terms of authority? Or, again, is that mostly in the Shiite tradition?
Well, the Sunni world has its own systems of authority. In this day and age, every country, every Muslim country, will have an office of decree, an office of iftah, which is the office which is responsible for issuing fatwas. And fatwas, some people, I do this thing in my class where I go over some common words that people might be familiar with, Arabic and Islamic words, and I say, what does fatwa mean? And a lot of students say, it means death sentence, you know. Because of how they hear it in the media. And the truth is, it just simply means religious decree or edict. And so every country will have an office of decree, and they will also have a mufti, the one who is responsible. And so he might be the overall authority. And in a place like Egypt, that person's office is typically a watered-down office, meaning that he can make a decree, and the office can make decrees, but it's only upon the believers and sort of their own followers how closely they'll follow that. So you have sort of parallel systems of authority where somebody else might be seen as a more authoritative scholar than even the state institution's appointed person, and in that sense, that person might gain some authority. So, for example, in Egypt, you have Sheikh Ali Guma, who is a very well-learned, very respectable man, who has he's sort of the Rowan Williams of the Muslim world today, and he's written a lot, interacted a lot with the West, and has many followers. And then you have a more strident, sort of politicized cleric who, until January or February, was living in exile in Qatar, Sheikh Yusuf Qaradawi, who is sort of seen as a brotherhood spokesman, Muslim brotherhood spokesman. And after the revolution, you can say that Qaradawi's credibility went up against that of Ali Guma's, mainly because of the very explicit political stance he took on the Egyptian revolution, whereas the state cleric, Ali Guma, you know, sort of said, you know, that things should go slowly and calmly and that we shouldn't, you know, rush into the street and demand the ousting of Mubarak. And Qaradawi said, do it right now. You know, the populace is going to somehow react to that. And it's very much the story in Islamic history between the quietists and the, you know, and the activist clerics on political issues. So in the Sunni world here, again, things are very sort of contextual in a place like Egypt. You might have three or four different people who are seen as the highest leaders and the highest offices, and what they say matters. But and again, you see a sort of Protestantism there, that you have this tendency to, for fracturing, for breaking off. But that's, the kind of decree, the decree duty is really what distinguishes the cleric. Now, there are other kinds of clerics that don't deal with law as much, but might deal with things like Quranic recitation. And on a day-to-day basis, this is likely the cleric that the Muslim family and the Muslim lay individual is going to come into contact with on a regular basis. The Muslim cleric who is a Quranic specialist simply dedicates their life to the memorization and recitation arts of the Quran. There's a certain style and recitation art and technique that one should learn the Quran with. And so this is the centerpiece of Muslim ritual life. So the numbers of Muslim clerics that have the Quran memorized and teach the families are innumerable. And we have in the United States now, we have African-American Muslims born to African-American Muslim converts from the 60s and before even, who have now gone to the Muslim world, who have memorized the entire Quran and are teaching it in, you know, mosques, let's say in Harlem or just down the street from me here in East Atlanta. You know, young African-American men and women who have gone and participated in this tradition, others who have gone to places like Yemen, Mauritania, Syria, to study with the gurus, if you will, of Islamic scholarship. And they all have different sort of emphases and functions, you know. There's also there are also the Sufi sheikhs who are really, they are also clerics in some ways, but they might focus more on the mystical dimension.
Yes. Now, Doctor, you mentioned before Sharia law and said it had a bad name. Are there misconceptions in the West about the clerics as well?
Yeah, I believe so, because I know that this probably goes back, as I would say, to the Iranian Revolution, where the very image of a cleric, you know, instigating a revolution both against their own government and against the West was, you know, embodied by Ayatollah Khomeini. And so that figure that the cleric is the sort of evil doctor of Sharia, which is, you know, the evil law, I believe that that's very much burnt in the brain. And the very, you know, physical, the physical look, the physical appearance of the cleric is a frightening sort of image that accompanies a lot of Islamophobic rhetoric out there. And it's so starkly different to the way in which, you know, Muslims themselves look at their clerics and their scholars, because it is with the utmost respect that Muslims, both Sunni and Shiite, deal with their scholars. They are honored guests in folks' homes. They are the ones who, you know, people send their children to memorize the Quran. In some cultures, Muslim cultures, it's very, very common custom to kiss the hands of the clerics you know, things like this. So it's sort of sad that how deep that misconception is.
And any, of course, any system of law created is, for example, it's the same, similar to the, you know, the very extensive, you know, Hebrew laws, which were basically intended to make life as good as possible. I mean, you know, with a positive intent.
Yeah, of course. I mean,
and to protect people, you know.
You know, the Sharia has a number of different what they call aims or goals, and these are, you know, the protection of religion itself, meaning, you know, the right to religion and sort of the path of God, something not to, you know, something shouldn't interfere with that because society as a whole is dependent upon that. And then immediately after that is human life, and then after that is human sanity, intellect, you know, reason. And then after that is honor and family relationships. And at the very bottom of the list of the goals of the Sharia is human wealth and property. So it's interesting when you think about the priorities that the system affords. I mean, the Sharia, like you said, was very much intended to make life, you know, reasonable and good, both for the individuals and for the collective good. And so, obviously, these things have gone under massive transformation in the last 200 years as an encounter with the sort of modern state. Sharia before was a system of ethics. It was a very personal, you know, individually based system where, you know, you got a fatwa from your scholar over your particular case. And it was never understood as codified law, but through the encounter with modernity and the rise of the nation state and the prominence of law in the nation state, the Sharia has turned into codified law, and Muslims themselves understand it now to be that way, especially the more strident activist type of Muslims in political Islam understand it to be that way. But at its core, Sharia is an ethical system largely divorced from any notion of law and judgment and, you know, policing and things like this. So it's interesting how far that's come.
Mm. We've got about 10 minutes left in the program, and if you wouldn't mind, I'd love to explore a little bit of your new work on the persistence of heresy.
Mm-hmm.
You have a couple.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I have a couple of folks there beside each other, Paul of Tarsus,
yeah,
and Ibn Saba.
Yeah.
And regarding the Sunni identity formation, I'd just love to explore that a little bit with you, if you wouldn't mind sharing, you know, particularly the place of Paul in your work. Because initially, you know, Christians would know him as Saul of Tarsus.
Yeah.
Later as the Apostle Paul,
exactly.
Who originally was a persecutor of Christ and a Roman and Jewish citizen.
Mm-hmm.
And he experienced his jarring conversion, as we say, knocked off our high horse, where that
exactly
came from, and became a key figure in the development of Christianity. Can you share with us, who is Ibn Saba, going, I guess, back to the 7th century?
Yes. Well, we're looking at the 8th century now. Oh, no, 7th century, excuse me. Yes, we're in the 7th century looking at this figure who is a very apocryphal figure. And my own historical sense is that he's a mythological figure, that he does not exist. But what we have is this very unique text in which there is a figure that is charged with introducing dissension and strife within the Muslim world, and that Ibn Saba is credited to have been a Jewish convert to Islam who only converted out of ill will to destroy the nascent Islamic movement, and that what his mission was to do was to create a sort of heresy that would destroy the movement from its inside. And so it's a kind of grand historical conspiracy theory, and he, Ibn Saba, is credited with basically everything terrible that happens after the Prophet's death, because there is a period of civil war about, you know, 30 years after the Prophet's death that is pretty painful for the early Muslim community. I mean, most of the sectarian divisions, their political sort of context goes back to that early civil war. And so Ibn Saba is, in Sunni texts, regarded as the person responsible for this. Now, the narrative of Paul of Tarsus amongst Sunni Muslims, and amongst Muslims in general, I shouldn't say it's Sunni Muslims only, the narrative of Paul is a very interesting one. And this is where all religions sort of have a sectarian tone. And so I want to preface what I'm about to say with sort of a comparison to the way in which Christianity reinterprets the Hebrew Bible in order to make sense of itself in the New Testament, and that is kind of reading the New Testament back into the Hebrew Bible. In this way, yeah. Islam does that to Christian and Jewish tradition as well, and it's just because Islam is the new kid on the block, so to speak. It has to account for what happened with Judaism and Christianity, because Islam lays claim to that whole prophetic tradition, so it must say, what happened exactly with Christianity? Why is Christianity no longer a viable religion to follow, and why is Islam the new and better version of that original monotheistic tradition? And so one of the many mechanisms through which Muslims explain this is through a concept called tahrif, which is sort of distortion, and Muslims believe that the New Testament has been distorted by human hand and has been corrupted as a historical text, and therefore the Quran is a better one to follow. Well, the figure of Paul in Quranic exegesis plays a central role in this concept of tahrif, of distortion, in that they believe Paul was a Jewish convert who converted to the original pure Christian movement and introduced the very heresy of the Trinity into Christianity in order to lead the followers astray. And so what you have is this very loaded sort of anti-Semitic.
Wow.
Yes, I'm sorry. You know, I didn't know how to talk about this because
wow.
the very mentioning of this is problematic. But this is a belief that exists in Quranic exegetical texts. Now, most Muslims I talk to have never even heard about Paul. They don't know who he is in the Christian tradition, and much less do they know about how he has been talked about in Islamic tradition. But the classic exegetes between the 8th and 11th centuries played with this story over and over again. And at some point, they came together and converged this story with the story of Ibn Saba, the person who caused dissent within their own community. And so there's a kind of a historical parallel being made in the figure of Ibn Saba, a Jewish convert who destroys Islam from the inside. You know, there's a parallel being made, a comparison being made between that figure and the mythological figure of Paul. And both of these figures are mythological, even if they might have historical precedent. They're mythological in the sense that their stories exceed their historical personas, regardless. And so
right.
what they do in terms of social function is much more important than who they might have been. And so it's problematic because it's an inherently polemical site to explore, and I hope it doesn't go too much against the grain or against the spirit of the programming. But the reason I bring it up in my work is that today the sectarian violence in the Muslim world has peaked, and in places like Bahrain, in Iraq, in Pakistan, you find the actual persistence of the Ibn Saba story used by radical extremists in the Sunni camp, like Al-Qaeda or the Taliban and its offshoots, to actually justify attacks on Shiites. And and it's colored with a sort of anti-Semitic overtone, that Shiites are the Jews of our community and that they should be dealt with and that their founder was a Jewish figure, etc. And it fits perfectly in with sort of grand narratives against Israel. And so it's a very problematic site. And what I've done in that article is to try to go back and understand both the textual sources of this myth and to ask, why has it retained such viability even into the modern age? And so it's a troublesome site, and it's a troublesome polemic, but the real reason I'm after it is that it's the very ground, it's the very myth that one has to tackle in order to get past certain sectarian, you know, problems and boundaries and borders. And so,
and Doctor, that is terribly important work. And not just for the, of course, Muslim tradition, but those are the root questions and causes, I think, for all of us as we express our faith. And we've come to the end of the hour. Unfortunately, I feel we could go on quite a bit.
Well, Carol, I really appreciate you having me, and thank you for the time. And, you know, I really hope in the future that I can be of service to you and your listeners.
Oh, thank you so much, and we'd love to speak with you again briefly. If listeners want to follow up and learn more about you and your work, is there a website you could direct them to?
Well, you can go to gsu.edu, which is Georgia State University. .edu, and I'm in the Department of Religious Studies there. You could punch in my name, Abbas Barzagar, and you could find me there. But I also invite listeners to find my articles on the Huffington Post or Al Jazeera and some other locations in the commentary and blogosphere. I'd be happy to receive comments.
Thank you so much. Thank you again for being with us today.
Okay, Carol. Take care. Thank you very much.
And thank you, listeners, for joining us for the Godspeed Institute today. This show was recorded live on the Progressive Radio Network in New York City, engineered by Barry Dwyer and produced by Michael Hallenbeck. If you would like to hear this or any of our previous shows again, or send it to someone, simply go to GodspeedInstitute.com, where you can also find my books on spirituality as well as a library of others. Join us again as we continue to explore all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Until then, we wish you Godspeed, always on your journey.